This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 Chai FM.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector. And as listeners know, we try to cover the landscape of topics. One week we might discuss issues in nuclear physics, and the next week we'll talk about international economics, and then the week after that we'll interview somebody who is active in theater, perhaps a prominent director, playwright, or actor, or dancer. And one of the topics that we have been rather negligent in covering, and that is not out of lack of interest or lack of importance, unfortunately, is education, and education as in the future of education. And it became pretty clear that one of the most appropriate people in South Africa to talk about this, of course, is Professor Jonathan Jansen. We could refer to, I guess, as a public intellectual on education, but a man who has also combined thinking about education with some serious action in it, doing it. For those few people in this audience who don't know him, he comes from the Western Cape, from Montague, and then brought up in Retreat. And he clearly advanced from Retreat rather dramatically. That's a bad pun, I know, but okay, we're moving on. There's a good book about it called Advanced Retreat by Richard Reeve, in case people don't know it, and that's where I steal the joke. His trajectory was he began as a biology teacher in high schools and then shifted focus, I guess, to the problems and the possibilities of education more broadly, educational administration, and had a very prominent and newsworthy period as the head of the University of the Free State after it had all but combusted over some racial animosities and incidents. He's a prolific writer, books like Knowledge in the Blood, Corrupted, A Study of Chronic Dysfunction in South African Universities, The Decolonization of Knowledge, and a book which is in front of me, Learning Lessons. He can see it, but you can't, obviously, because you're listening on radio. I think Professor Jansen's never been one of those people to keep his opinions under his hat. He's well known for staking out his territory and letting us know what he thinks and why he thinks of it. And I think it's only appropriate then to welcome you and let's talk about education. This is the period when students graduate from universities, they go through their ceremonies, they get their certificate, and then they go into the world of work. But there are challenges, problems, and pitfalls ahead. In any case, I welcome you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Brooke. Privilege to be with you.
Let's get right to it. You've staked out your territory that there is a crisis in South African education. Some of the obvious things are the throughput of people who enter primary education versus the number of people who actually exit from it, the quality of what it is they're learning, and the way in which they're taught in universities. And indeed, the question of whether what they learn in universities is going to stand them in good stead at the world of work. And I should have also mentioned, I'm sorry, I left this part out. You have a research position at Stellenbosch University, and you have a long connection with Stanford University, where you received, I believe, a PhD as well. Neither of those are inconsequential institutions, for sure. But take me through the nature of your critique of South Africa's educational crisis or crises.
Thank you. So, you know, my sense of education is that it is a commitment we make, a public commitment to educate young people about themselves, about their country, about the world, and that education in that sense is much broader than training. If I want to train you to be a mechanic who fixes cars, there's a very specific set of skills, of tools, of techniques that you need to learn, and that is worthwhile, obviously. But education is more than that. Education is about higher purposes. Education is about working with the ideals of young people and bringing that to fruition. Education is about developing within our young people a sense of criticality, an approach to the world that's not cynical, that's not skeptical, but that asks questions of the things that we hold dear, whether in faith or in science and so on. So to the extent that education, therefore, is a values enterprise, I think that we have just, you know, failed our young people, not only in the provision of hard skills, but in the provision of a humanity, you know, an attitude towards the world, a sense of yourself and of others, a way of committing yourself to something bigger than yourself. I don't think we've done that. And so if you just look at our high schools, for example, the entire high school syllabus or curriculum is geared towards getting optimizing matric results, or what we used to call matric results, now called the national semester results. The entire, so I've worked in high school over 2 years, turn it around, but also to teach in, as part of that devotion. And I am surprised at how mechanical, how narrow, how instrumental, you know, this thing called education has become. And so schools play all kinds of games, for example, to maximize grade 12 results, because there's huge rewards if you do well, but there's huge embarrassment if you don't. And so this is not a particularly South African phenomenon. You see this across the world, that we have narrowed down those purposes to final results. And where do I see the results of that kind of madness? When I get my first year students and they've got 7 distinctions from some of the most, you know, the more elite schools in the Western Cape and nationally, they come to Stellenbosch, and my first 2 or 3 tests, they all get 0, because what they've learned at school is how to memorize, how to give back, how to parrot, how to work out algorithms, you know, to help them solve problems. None of them have ever read a book from cover to cover. In other words, the kinds of things that a humanities orientation should do in our high school. All the schools have done with them is to lock their minds into this notion that if I can learn minutiae, if I can learn how to pass, then I would have made it in life. Well, I'm sorry, but when you get to my third year class already, which I'm teaching this year, which is 230 kids, students, they fail at class because they can't think for themselves. They cannot think outside of ChatGPT. They cannot read a book. They cannot evaluate an argument. They cannot take a position other than their own and defend that position public square. So I have to re-educate these young people, or educate them for the first time, actually, by showing them how to work with argument and opinion, how to distinguish fact from fiction, how to, you know, how to read and hold a position. So it doesn't mean that there aren't more and more young people passing high school, but it does mean they're not passing life.
We're going to take a very quick ad break, station break, and then I'm going to go into what you've just said with a little bit more detail. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and very pleased to have as our guest today, Professor Jonathan Jansen. And we are talking education. We're talking all things education. And we will be right back after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, of course, and my guest today, real privilege, Professor Jonathan Jansen. And you talk about having to educate or re-educate your students into learning the art and quote-unquote science of evaluating fact versus fiction, of discourse, of evaluating arguments. This is a critique that's being raised frequently, not just in South Africa, of course, but in the United States as well, in which universities find that their students have not read a complete work, let alone lots of works of fiction and academic prose. But one of the things that I've been following over the years, about 10, 15 years ago, there was a great push to send students into the field of computer science and specifically coding, in being able to write programs which will govern the way things are done, the way we work, and so forth. And now suddenly we have discovered that AI is about ready to write its own programs, and all that effort of producing talented coders is perhaps going to waste or worse. Do you see this phenomenon here as well? Are we losing track of what's important by urging people to pick up very narrow areas in the STEM universe?
Yeah, I think so. Look, you know, I'm a STEM person. I absolutely love science and mathematics and computer science and so on and so forth. So I'm you know, I'm an evangelist for the world of technology and so on. But I also recognize its limits. I also recognize its dangers. So, for example, if you look, what's the biggest debate on campuses around the world right now? It's assessment integrity. In other words, how do you prevent kids from cheating by simply, you know, going to one of these large language models and so on? So I get that. But for me, this is a beautiful challenge. You know, if you ask dumb questions, you will get the dumb answers, the mechanical answers that is available on chat, for example. And so for me, one of the situation is to really force academics, teachers, to design questions that have complexity in it, that has nuance in it, that has more context in it. When I ask my students questions like that, there is no way in which they can simply lazily, you know, down on technical platforms. They can't. And so it's really funny for me because I say to them, bring your textbook, your written notes, bring your laptop, your device, bring whatever you wish into my classroom, but these are the 10 questions. And I can tell you my average in the first few tests is about 0 to 25, in that range, and so on. And the reason it's in that range is because I have to think 3 steps ahead of the technology, without denying the technology. So to take this more broadly, one of the best quotes I've seen from my old university at Stanford is, I do want my students to understand these technologies. I do want them to master some of, you know, the dark spaces within it. I do want kids to learn about robotics and all that because the world is changing in that direction. But I also want them to know the humanities. I also want them to be able to make good judgments and to discern good from bad. That's what I also want. And that, unfortunately, cannot be taught through machines. That has taught through history, through sociology, through the classics, and so on and so forth. And so this is not an either-or debate. This is how do you bring humanity into into this new world of technology. I'll give you an example. I was in San Francisco with some of my doctoral students, training them how to present at top conferences, research conferences. And, you know, it was so wonderful to step outside of this venue. And I'm not exaggerating if I tell you that 3 out of every 5 cars were autonomous vehicles. They drove themselves, right? What was this particular is, long before the car came, you could load your music that you wanted the car to play during the time of your, you know, backseat. So imagine this, right? Here is a superb piece of technology, an autonomous vehicle, but you can listen to Rachmaninoff's, you know, second movement, the third section of that, which is one of the most beautiful pieces in the world. And so here you have a humanities experience inside an unbelievable piece of technology. That's, for me, emblematic of the world I'm dreaming about, you know, which is a world that is inevitably high tech, but with all the dangers of cutting us off from our emotions, cutting us off from our own judgments, cutting us off from those things that make us human, okay, and so on. So what we've got to figure out is how to create a world in which both these things exist, these very rapid advances in technology, without losing our bearings, our foundations as human beings.
I went to university even before you did. I'm just a few years older than you. And right. I remember taking a course in statistical methodologies for social sciences right. on one hand, and philosophy and political ideology classes where we had to read the originals, the Platos and the Machiavellis and the Paritos and various other figures. So for the statistics course, the final exam instructor says, copy any of the formula. This is long before you had a laptop available to you. Copy any of the formulas you wish onto a small index card. Bring it with, not a problem. And of course, being the industrious type, I copied every formula out of the book. And the index card was so thick with writing, I couldn't find any of the formulas that I needed to know. It was a total black smudge. In the meantime, in recent years, certainly, I find myself going back to those early foundational texts, but I'm no longer looking at them in the printed version on the bookshelf. I'm using my laptop to find the chapter or the section that I need to use. It's a version of your story of the social scientist or the education specialist sitting in an autonomous vehicle learning or working on their presentation while Rachmaninoff's piano concerto is playing away softly in the background. And I wonder, though, whether or not people now studying understand that these two worlds, in that famous C.P. Snow essay about the world of the humanities and the world of the sciences, whether they understand that they overlap to some degree, but they represent different things at the same time? Or are people so captured by the one that they forget the other?
Well, you know, I have bad news for you. I work in schools and universities. My own recent publications cover the humanities and as well as engineering. And I'll send you a piece, if you wish, on this. And the answer is,
please
we live, we'll do. We live in completely different worlds. So I tried to, at Stellenbosch, introduce a core curriculum. You know, the U.S. system, Columbia had that at one point, that a model, Stanford had a controversial one. But to introduce a core curriculum in that whatever your major is going to be, you will learn about law and ethics. You will learn about, you know, astronomy and nanotechnology. You would learn about philosophy. And you know, I couldn't get my colleagues to buy in. I could do that when I was at the Free State because I was the vice chancellor and I could persuade the Senate to go along. But the world doesn't, it's very hard to explain this because the world doesn't come to us as discipline. The world comes to us as a real problem. And if we don't recognize that, it can kill people. Give an example of that. I was horrified when I realized that the president's panel or the minister's panel during COVID only had people on the panel who were epidemiologists, infectious disease experts, vaccinologists, and the like. There wasn't a single sociologist. There wasn't a single. And the result was when they borrowed a policy language from the United States called social distancing, they insisted, if you recall, that we all, you know, remain in our homes, and that we cut ourselves off from friends and family, and this is social distancing. Nobody had ever asked in an African, South African context, how do you do that in a shack? You do that in a shack. So this guy gets fed up because there's 20 people in his shack in Alexandria in Johannesburg. And he goes out, and you might remember the military, the police just shot and killed him because he's supposed to socially distance, okay? Nobody said, there was no economist there to say, hey, a lot of our people who sell food and so on the streets, if you insist they socially distance, they have an option between staying indoors and starving. You know, but nobody thought about these complexities. And the reason is we think the world exists in that context in the form of the biomedical disciplines. It doesn't. It never was the case. And so unless you understand, let me just give you one more example, unless you understand tuberculosis as not simply a disease, you know, of a bacterial disease, you know, and affects the lungs and so on and so forth, but you also understand that it exists in places where poor people live. In other words, in compact housing situations, lack of ventilation, all of that stuff. It's a social and a medical problem. And I've been, you know, sort of single-handedly trying to convince my colleagues to change the curriculum, to broaden it, to give people a sense, again, where I started, of being educated rather than being trained in a narrow discipline. So I'm afraid the same is true when it comes to these new technologies. Is if you go to, I'm on the second floor of a building at Stellenbosch. For the past 9 years, I would go to the toilet twice a day, and I'd walk past these lecture halls. You know, they still have a professor standing and talking for 50 minutes or a double period without any sense of participation, without any sense of the uses of these technologies, et cetera, et cetera. And so teaching and learning, you know, except for the cheating part, is by and large exactly the same way it was 10, 20, 50 years ago. And that saddens me.
It's probably the same the way it was in 1500.
Yeah, correct.
We're going to take a very quick station break, and we'll be right back. We're speaking with Professor Jonathan Jansen. This is the Deep Dive on Chai FM, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and we'll be back after these messages. As we used to say in the analog era, don't touch that dial. We'll be right back.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is the Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, of course. Today's guest, I'm delighted, Professor Jonathan Jansen, and we're talking about the combination or the combustion between the world of the humanities and humanities and social sciences, really, and the world of technology and science and the way in which they interact or don't. I want to turn your attention to a news item which broke over us just a couple days ago. The government had issued a draft framework for the use of artificial intelligence, AI, and it turned out that in the document there were fictitious references to papers and research documents that didn't exist. In essence, then, the AI tool that they chose to use decided to not just plagiarize, I guess, but to invent material as references that had no relationship to actual study. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, that came out at about the same time that our government announced a new revised history curriculum. And in both cases, you know, for the past 30 years, I have to be honest with you, I've become incredibly skeptical of anything in the policy world that comes out of the South African government. It's often fictitious. It's often unrealistic. It's often bold statements without the backing those up with resources. It's fanciful, you know, and there's a part of my scholarly life that focuses on policy as performance, you know, and as symbolism. And there's a big literature on this, as you know. So I'm not surprised by that at all. It's embarrassing. It's deeply embarrassing. And a friend of mine, Stafford Marcy, who is probably the leading thinker on these technologies, did a critique of the AI policy, which you have to read. It's Marcy, as in Masie. It's worth reading, because I haven't really done a deep dive, to coin a phrase, into the policy, but almost everything he says and what I've just learned from you is completely to be expected from a government that doesn't do its own original thinking, that mimics and imitates policies from elsewhere, and then doesn't do the hard work necessary to make these things intelligible to all our people. So, yeah, I'm sad to hear that.
Well, I mean, a friend of mine and I, we did an experiment about a year ago with AI. because I do a lot of writing, obviously, there's a lot of stuff on the internet that has my name attached to it in some way. We decided that we would ask, I think it was ChatGPT, that to write an article, 500 words, on topic X, but recognizably using my voice, my written voice. And what came out was not bad, but it really did sound a lot like me, but it wasn't really a deep piece of analysis by any means. And we went through a couple of iterations, and finally we asked it to be more authentic and more, shall we say, more argumentative. And what we got back at the last turn of the wheel was me, but it sounded like I'd had way too much coffee and I was on some sort of upper, so that it, you know, I was virtually screaming off the page about this, but it still sounded like me. And this, what I'm getting at is that this whole process is still manipulable by people, and the machinery doesn't have that ability to consider the effect of what it's saying. It doesn't have, in a word, consciousness, I guess.
Yeah, and whatever the limits of the technology is at the moment, it is a matter of time before it gets better at that, right? Better at mimicking your voice, better at making the technology you indistinguishable from the human you. So I have no doubt that in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, there'll be advances in the technology that will enhance the experience of authenticity. Now, what that means for me as a humanities scholar, a social science scholar, is how do we stay ahead of this game? Just to give you an example, one of the things that absolutely fascinates me, and I'll be writing a piece on this, is how many people are beginning to give authority to this technology to imitate intimate relationships, right? So since the movie Her, I've been fascinated by how an intelligent human being can fall in love with his disk operating system, right? which enables you to come home and be warmly welcomed and be told that you're loved and all of this stuff. And how every year this gets to be more real, you know, in the minds of people. How to have a grief bot, for example, that uses your late mother's voice, and inputs all of, you know, her writings, her thinking, and so on, so that you literally come to believe that you're talking to your dead mother, you know. Now, I'm not as judgmental about this as I used to be, because I really believe that if people are grieving deeply and that is their way out of it, who am I to judge? But I also am very conscious of the fact that sooner or later, there's going to be very severe consequences of this, not just legally, but also, you know, emotionally and psychologically and so on. Because it's simply not real, no matter what you do, right? Again, I don't know where the deep thinking, again, to borrow a phrase here, I don't know where the deep thinking is happening in philosophy departments, in among the best minds in our world, you know, about how to deal again with this intersection of the human and the technology.
Professor, we're going to have to take another ad break. Of course, we have to pay the piper. This is The Deep Dive. I'm delighted to be speaking with Professor Jonathan Jansen, your host, Brooke Spector on IFM, and we'll be right back after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, on Chai FM, and my guest today, I'm really pleased to finally do this, Professor Jonathan Jansen. And at first I thought we were going to talk more about reforming education, and we have veered rather dramatically into the world of, well, two worlds, really, the world of what's real and what's not electronically, as well as the way in which the electronic universe is going to and already is affecting who we are and how we behave. And just before the break, the discussion turned to the question of people who are grieving for the loss of a relative, a friend, a partner. AI allows you to reconstructs a persona of that person. And I have seen a television show in which the video version of that individual, the mobile to a grieving person, I suspect that's really right on the horizon for real. And if that's the case, we're increasingly not going to know who we're talking to either. We're not going to know who we're engaged with, and we will be engaged with artificial individuals or past presence of individuals. They will never leave us. This is going to change us as people, is it not?
It will. And there are huge, as I said, ethical questions, legal questions, psychological questions that we have to grapple with in these early stages of this indistinction that is happening between the human between humans and technology. That is very, very important for the sake of our humanity. That said, it's inevitable. It's happening. It is going to continue to happen, and it will become more sophisticated. And that is why I believe that education, just to tie the knot here, is teaching in particular, is such an important component of this moment, right? And so it's very hard, to give an example, it's very hard to tell young people, don't cheat, okay, by using ChatGPT, for example, because it's meaningless. If a kid is under pressure with 7 causes and 21 deadlines, they will cheat, right? What we don't do in universities is to tell them why not to cheat, okay? Is to say to them, do you understand you're giving up your own voice? You are giving up your own, you're giving up your integrity here. And so instead of just giving rules on a website about the university's policy on AI, which I find so ridiculous, engage young people through the teaching process, okay, about why this is bad for you, okay? And so on, those deliberative moments are completely absent from our education because we think we can simply change human behavior with a policy statement.
It sounds to me as if you are, in effect, arguing that we really need to turn the clock back to about 430 BCE with Socrates on one end of the log and a student on the other, and Socrates says, what is a good man and how do we know?
Yeah.
And how we evaluate his goodness?
And it is precisely, that's a beautiful way of putting it, and it's precisely the absence of a Plato. Take Machiavelli, whom you referenced earlier. I think it's really very important for any young person, whether you're in political science or whether you're in, chemical engineering, to grapple with the question of authority and politics and the human heart, right? Mm. But we don't. And then we're very surprised when people behave badly. I mean, just take the world as it stands at the moment. Did you realize how easy it is for very powerful military forces in the world talk? These are political leaders, right? Talk about taking out people. We're going to take out somebody if they don't open the Strait of Hormuz, or we're going to take out. And you have the slaughterhouse of babies, of children, of mothers, of fathers. And I just can't believe how easy it has become to kill, in the hands of the state. And that is, again, a consequence of us disengaging from those deliberative discussions about, as you said, I love that question, of course, what does it mean to be human? What is the purpose of life? What is worth living for? When you are not educating in that sense, you make it easier for lives to be seen as dispensable, And I know you probably don't want to go there, but I often say to people with regards to the horrific situation in Gaza, and I've got friends on both sides of that debate, but let me tell you what the big thing is they all miss, and that is the inability to cry twice. I only cry for my side, okay? Because there is a humanity that precedes politics, but we don't see that. And so we immediately fall into position taking and forget the human at the center of these crises. And South Africa is a case in point when it comes to the ease with which we talk about. Years ago, I still remember this as a child, that when somebody died in a township, it was an issue. The old women, the gogos, would come and sit around the body, whether they knew the person or not. There would be a blanket pulled over this corporeal entity. They would be crying. They would be praying. They would be, you know, and often people don't know the person. But it was a moment, okay? I have been in situations in current contemporary South Africa where people literally walk over a dead body on the way to school or work and so on. There is something we have lost, not just in South Africa. We've lost something in our ability to mourn.
I would extend your metaphor, and I certainly don't mind you having made that statement. The same people who, to some degree, will bemoan what's happening in the example you cited are absolutely oblivious to what's happening, 900 miles to the north of us in Sudan. Which hundreds of thousands of people are dying and millions are starving and tens of millions are in forced migrations. And the response I get to that question is a sort of a mumbled, well, and the answer is, I don't get an answer, is essentially what I'm saying, that doesn't matter. Unfortunately, we have to take a quick break for station identification and commercial messages. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. My guest today, Professor Jonathan Jansen. And we originally were going to talk about education policy, but wow, we have really moved into how do we measure humanity in an electronic age? And we'll be right back for a summing up after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. My guest today, we're finishing off the hour with Professor Jonathan Jansen. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, on IFM. And we were talking just before the break about the way in which a common humanity has evaporated in some considerable degree from our daily life. And I guess the fear is that our further integration with the machine, with the electronics, is only going to exacerbate that kind of thing. Your final thoughts on that, sir? Is there a way to turn this around, or are we in serious trouble and there's no off-ramp?
No, thank God for institutions. We have many, many institutions that need to play this educative role in a moment in which it seems we are going to crash, right? This enormous speed with which the world is being transformed through technology can be slowed down. It can't be stopped, but it can be slowed down through all our institutions playing a role in this, one of the most important being our educational institutions. So I do believe that schools and universities need to wake up, you know, and begin to engage these issues to make more prominent the role of the humanities, especially in the context of evolving technologies. I would love to see the entire curriculum scrapped for schools, you know, and reorganized to begin to address some of these foundational questions about what it means to be human. What does it mean to be successful? What does it mean to engage? What does it mean to think, you know, etc.? I would like to see a lot more of that kind of thing happening, in the absence of which we are staring at a calamity. And so on. Just think of the power of these new technologies to launch us into nuclear warfare, right? Before we've gotten our ethical socks on, you know? I mean, that's what we are. So I listen a lot to people with more wisdom about AI and associated technologies, and I'm scared, but all of them say there's a way out of this. My way out of this is through education, because ultimately we have been gifted with brains. We've been gifted with the ability to make good decisions in the midst of a crisis, but that is only going to happen if the brain is exercised, if the whole human body is exercised to make those kinds of decisions. And that, again, is education.
You raised nuclear war. I only have like a minute left, but the thing that scares me most right now, less the possibility of an actual all-out nuclear war, is what I think of as autonomous fighting vehicles, fighting machinery that makes the decisions on its own. This target versus that target, many targets. And I think that we are just about on the cusp of that. And as humans, we're going to have to figure out a way to, you know, to keep that leash on somehow.
No, that's absolutely true.
Unfortunately, we must leave it here because we have to make way for the next program. But there is lots more to talk about. We're going to have this conversation part two again sometime down the road a little bit when you're free. We have been speaking with Professor Jonathan Janssen, now of Stellenbosch, but a long distinguished career in the United States and in South Africa. Started out as a biology teacher and now has become one of the country's preeminent public intellectuals. We didn't talk so much about his education theories and ideas, but much broader and I think more important issues and themes, and a lot about the interweaving of technology and humanity. And I thank you for that. I mean, I'm really pleased we had this conversation.
Thank you, Brooks, and good luck.
And we'll talk again in the future. Next week, we'll be back with another guest. Can't tell you what the topic is or who it is, but it will be a topic which I hope will be of interest to many of you in your audience. In the meantime, everybody, please be safe, be careful, have a good weekend. You take care.